Welcome to the Back Issue Banter Podcast. We're your hosts, Brad Page
and Chris Caron. Each episode, we'll look back at some of our favorite issues and storylines, along with the creators behind those books, celebrating what we love about comics.
So grab those trade paperbacks off the bookshelf, rummage through your long boxes, or fire up your digital reader and join us for some Back Issue Banter.
Welcome to Back Issue Banter, the show where, by Crom, we cover comics. I'm Chris Caron.
And I'm Brad Page.
And Brad laughed once again. That's my goal in life, folks, is to make Brad laugh.
By Crom.
By Crom. And by that declaration, it's pretty obvious that we're going to be talking about Conan the Barbarian, of course, the Marvel Comics version, because the licenses shifted around in recent years. In fact, Marvel got it back a few years ago, and then now it's somebody else has it.
Right, yeah, very recently they lost the license, or the, I don't know if that's the proper terminology,
but yeah, no,
they have the license.
Yep. But anyway, and we're gonna do something a little off the beaten path. We are gonna do the first two issues of Conan the Barbarian. And then we're going to do 23 and 24. Now, there's a reason for why they're not four consecutive issues, and that will become apparent as we talk about the individual issues. But obviously, you know, this was a book that was adapted by Roy Thomas, who was the writer and later the editor as well. I think he was like the editor-in-chief.
Yeah, so Roy Thomas, a little bit of history. Of course, we talked about Roy on the podcast before, I think on the Avengers episodes we did. But Roy was born in November 1940 in Jackson, Missouri. He was friends with a guy named Jerry Bales, who started Alter Ego, which is one of the very first serious comic fanzines. And by 1964, Roy had taken over editing Alter Ego. And you know, Roy was a hardcore fan. He wrote letters to both Marvel and DC that got published. He's got letters published in Fantastic Four 5 and in issue 15 and a few others. In 1965, he moves to New York City to take a job with DC, working for Mort Weisinger, who was a bully. And Roy lasted, I think he said, 8 days at DC before he quit. And he went over to Marvel, met with Stan. Stan gave him a writing test that he took home and did and turned it in. And Stan gave him a job, which was became significant because Roy was really the first writer to take over Stan's bulk of work. I mean, there were other writers who would do an issue here and there. Probably the most common one is Larry Lieber, who was Stan's brother. And Larry wrote a few, quite a few issues of Marvel. But at the time, mostly it was Stan doing all of the writing. And it was a lot for one guy to do, plus being the editor and everything else. And when Stan felt comfortable with Roy, he was really the first guy, kind of became like his protege. And Roy started writing Marvel books. I believe Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos number 29, I think, was the first issue that Roy wrote for Marvel. And then went on to do some other stuff. And in 1970, he launched Conan with artist Barry Smith. You want to talk about Barry?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, Barry Windsor Smith. He was born in Forest Gate, London, United Kingdom. And just to show you that how ill-prepared I am, obviously by the late 60s, he was an artist and he had come over to America and he dropped into Marvel Comics. And there were some issues with his immigration status. And in fact, at one point, I believe he was kicked out of the country because he overstayed his visa. They worked things out. And by the late 60s, 67, 68, he was working fairly regularly at Marvel.
I think his first published work was X-Men 53 with Marvel in the States. He had done some pinups and stuff for the British reprints, but it was X-Men 53. And then Roy assigned him to do Avengers 66 and 67, which are kind of key issues because those are the issues that introduced Adamantium, which has gone on to become such a huge thing in the
Marvel
universe.
Never heard of it.
And then, of course, in 1970 with Roy, he takes over or they launch Conan together.
Right. Right. And the interesting thing about Conan was that by, you know, the late 60s, of course, by this point, Roy Thomas is like Stan's assistant. He's like the assistant editor and he's writing some books. They were getting besieged by people wanting them to do sword and sorcery. And but more specifically, to license a character. Like, I know from reading Roy's introduction to the Omnibus, two of the biggies were J.R. Tolkien, you know, and Lord of the Rings, and of course, Edgar Rice Burroughs, Tarzan. And originally, and by this point too, Roy Thomas had discovered the Conan paperbacks, and he originally said he bought them because he loved the Frank Frazetta artwork. I mean, you know, we can't...
How can you not, right?
Yeah, exactly. But then he read them and really kind of really enjoyed them and became a fan. And, you know, but then he decided to, they just were negotiating for some character called Thongor. I guess Stan thought it sounded like a better name, Thongor, you know. And it was written by an author named Lynn Carter, who actually was also co-writing some of the Conan paperbacks, because what they were doing, they were taking the original Robert E. Howard stories. Robert E. Howard, of course, was the creator of Conan and wrote the original stories back in the 1930s before he killed himself at a very early age. He was in his mid-30s. But so they decided to sort of embellish the stories and put them in a chronological order. So L. Sprague de Camp and Lynn Carter were writing these. And the other thing, too, that I found out later, they were also rewriting some of Robert E. Howard stuff, because some of it was not politically correct. There were some racial elements in there that were kind of troubling by today's standards, but I don't agree with them rewriting them. I think they should be presented as is, and you can just decide for yourself if you like them or not. Anyway, Thongor did not work out. And Stan let Roy do this because Stan really wasn't a big sword and sorcery guy. He really didn't follow it, and he didn't understand it the way Roy did. So, well, eventually they got in touch with Glenn Lord, who was literary agent for the Robert E. Howard estate, and they negotiated a fee, a licensing fee of $150 per issue. That's all you think about that. That's a lot of money in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
Roy was authorized to give $150, but Roy thought it was kind of small, so he told Glenn Lord that they could go as high, that they could do 200. And Glenn Lord said, okay, sure, signed over a contract. So they did. Now, this is where, obviously, if they were going to pay that kind of money, it had to come out of the budget. They originally wanted John Buscema to draw Conan. And, of course, as we know, he later would become the key artist on Conan for, well over a decade. But because of the fact that the license fee was so high, he was also getting one of their higher page rates. So Buscema was out. They had to get somebody else. And so Barry Windsor Smith comes in, or Barry Smith, as he was known back then. And, you know, we'll get into this more, but you look at his, especially that first issue, Conan does not look as big and menacing as he would look under Buscema. Since we've already done the backstory, Brad, why don't you give us a summation of Conan the Barbarian number one?
Okay.
Conan the Barbarian, issue number one, The Coming of Conan, October 1970. Written by Roy Thomas, pencils by Barry Smith, inks Dan Adkins. Thousands of years ago in the Hyborian Age, a young Sumerian named Conan rescues Olaf and joins his clan. But they are attacked, and winged creatures deliver Conan to the castle of the shaman, where he sees visions of the past and of his own future as he is to be crowned King Conan.
So this comes out in 1970, and of course, you know, it's got to have the big bright Marvel cover that says The Coming of Conan. You can almost see Stan Lee like narrating it. And
like all Marvel books, right?
There's right. And to the point where Barry Windsor Smith was kind of, I don't want to say accused, but he was definitely thought to have had a big Kirby influence, especially in that first issue. And I can kind of see it.
Yeah, I don't know. To me, it kind of looked more like Buscema-ish, but I think it's very good comic book art.
Yeah.
Very good storytelling. The characters all look great, but it is not distinctive.
No.
It, you know, I hate, I don't want to use, I don't want to use the word generic because that downplays it, but it's, you know, it looks of a piece of other Marvel work at the time. Yeah. Whereas if you look 2 years down the road, which we will in a bit, it's a whole different thing. Yeah. So his art is very much evolving in this period, as many of the great artists did.
Well, keep in mind, too, that we both know that all the artists who were brought, you know, on board in the late 60s were all told to draw the house style.
Yeah, which was Kirby.
Yeah, Jack Kirby. So, you know, he does draw. And the interesting thing, there's some very interesting things about this. In the last episode and in other episodes, you've talked about the fact that you miss thought balloons. There are no thought balloons in Conan. And there's a reason. Roy Thomas, I was doing a little research, and Roy Thomas did an interview. I think it was for like the movie, like a bonus feature on the movie DVD. And he said that in the original Robert E. Howard books, you never really got inside his head. It was all show, don't tell. So he made a conscious decision to not have thought balloons. He wanted it to be distinctive from other Marvel comics at the time, in which it was. And the other thing is that there are no nonverbal sound effects.
Yes, that I noticed. Yeah.
Yeah. So those are two very distinctive things, and those were big things for a 1970s comic.
Yeah, definitely breaking the Marvel mold, because thought balloons and especially those big sound effects were such a part of comics in general and Marvel in particular. I mean, they were always inventing new ways to make, you know, foom and just these really alliterative, onomatopoeia type of words that they could always come up with. But there's really none of it in these books, which kind of makes them a little bit more, I don't know if you could ever say a sword and sorcery barbarian book is subtle, but it does, right. I think, inject probably an effective amount of subtlety in a book that would have desperately needed it if they hadn't done that, I think.
And another thing, too, that I read years ago was that Conan in this first issue is about 17 or 18 years old. He's a very young, he's kind of like starting out, basically. But in every year of Conan the Barbarian comics, he actually ages a year in real time. And you can kind of see it as he gets older, especially with the John Buscema issues. But he's very young, and he wears that horned helmet, which, by the way, Roy Thomas and Barry Windsor Smith had done a Barbarian story, not Conan, previously. And I think it was Strange Adventures. It was like a one-shot, you know, fill-in issue kind of thing. Well, the character in that was kind of basically it was like a proto-Conan. It was called Star the Slayer. And yeah, he had that horned hat. So they basically figured, well, we created it. You know, the horn hat you'll see in this issue, and I think the next issue, gets lost eventually. I guess they just decided that they didn't need it anymore. But, you know, it's kind of like, I hate to say this, but when I saw that QAnon shaman at the January 6th riots, I'm like, this guy looks like he's out of a Conan book, except Conan would kill this guy. But anyway, okay, enough yakking about politics.
Yeah, it's, I guess it's kind of a residual thing from the Marvel books of, you know, superheroes got to have a costume. They got to have some identifiable features or, traits or whatever. And I when you got a guy who's basically got a sword and a loincloth and not a whole lot else, a particular horn helmet is a way to give the guy something resembling a costume.
The interesting thing, too, was that Roy Thomas originally was going to write this for maybe like the first couple of issues and then pawn it, give it to someone else like Jerry Conway. Roy obviously stuck with it. In fact, he wrote Conan for basically 10 years straight.
Yeah.
And we're not just talking Conan the Barbarian. There was Savage Sword of Conan, which was like a full, you know, like almost like a double-sized magazine. And then later in the decade, King Conan, he did the first five issues of that. So, you know, Roy Thomas probably wrote, and then he came back like in the 90s to do some issues as well. So we're talking, he probably wrote upwards of 200 Conan books, I would think.
Yeah. I think it's got to be the one thing that he wrote more than anything else. I can't imagine.
Well, he loved it. He just, he, he just said, you know, he stuck with it because he really loved it. And he, you know, I think next to Robert E. Howard himself, Roy Thomas is probably the most identified when, you know, writer when it comes to Conan. You know, he obviously, arguably, he wrote more than Robert E. Howard, because Robert E. Howard only did like a series of short stories. He was prolific, and he they were the thing about the Conans is that they were mostly short stories, which is why these other writers had to kind of write these pastiches to kind of stitch them all together. He only wrote one Conan novel in his, you know, life. But and of course, you know, the state has licensed other writers. I've always found it interesting that Roy Thomas never wrote a Conan novel, like prose novel, but I think he might have written one and it got rejected, which I kind of find interesting. But I guess, you know, they come out swinging with this issue. It's definitely a Marvel comic book from 1970. It's bright, it's engaging, you know, and the drawing is very,
Action-packed for sure.
and Conan may not look as muscular, but you know, you could be argued that he's 16 or 17 years old. You know, maybe he hasn't fully developed yet. But he's definitely got that thing. Conan almost never smiles. He's very, you know, very grim, very single-minded about accomplishing his task. And of course, he comes across the most interesting creatures. And you know, like in this issue, you know, he's got these Gondor and Hothnar and Sharkosh the Shaman. And they even reference King Kull, which was another creation of Robert E. Howard, who also had some comic books out in the 70s. But the King Kull never ever approached the popularity of Conan. In fact, Conan was so popular that by the mid 70s, when Marvel issued their own coins, their own commemorative coins, it was Spider-Man, Hulk, and Conan. I mean, Marvel had that license for, I think, 25 years or over 20 years at least. So. But you know, this is a good first issue. It's you know, kind of like a mission. It's almost like here's a rough sketch, but the best is yet to come.
Well, the thing that intrigued me about it, and I had never read these books before. I'm not really a sword and sorcery guy. It's kind of not in my wheelhouse. So it was interesting to read these. But sort of what caught me is how at the end of the book, they basically tell you the end of or where the story's going to end up like years from now, right? With he gets a vision of himself being crowned King Conan. They kind of lay out the path where this could go, and so it's left up to you to kind of imagine how this, 17-year-old unsophisticated, it doesn't seem like he doesn't have any property, he doesn't have any followers, he's just this guy. How does he end up king?
Well, it's funny that initially that part of the contract was they could not adapt Robert E. Howard stories. They had to come up with their own. Eventually, that was relaxed. I think what that means is they offered them more money to adapt the stories. And eventually they would be adapted. And like, but Roy was very smart in that he would space them out. Like he thought in terms of like how old would Conan be when he becomes the king. So, you know, the King Conan comic doesn't come out till the late 70s, but I think even then it's indicated that that's off in the future. He's an older man. I mean, there was talk a few years ago of Schwarzenegger coming back and doing King Conan, which they probably could have done because he's older now. He might be too old for it now, but
Probably too old now, but
yeah, exactly. You know, but I mean, you know, they tried doing a Conan movie back in I think 2011 with Jason Momoa, and it was just basically a sword and sorcery generic action sword and sorcery movie. No reflection on Jason Momoa, just the filmmakers. Even the Schwarzenegger films are closer to the Robert E. Howard stories. But I don't have too much to say about the first issue because, you know, this is just sort of like the coming of Conan. And of course, you know, you have that great splash page where it's not even part of the story where, oh, hither, you know, no, O King, the legend of Conan, you know. And it's very, again, it's done in the Marvel style. It's almost like Stan and Jack did it. Although I would like to have seen Jack Kirby, his interpretation of, you know, Conan. That would have been
Could be
interesting.
interesting. I don't think he's the right guy for a
No.
book like this, but it could have been interesting. Well, let's talk about the second issue.
All right, Brad, take it away.
Conan the Barbarian, number two, Lair of the Beastmen, December 1970. Roy Thomas writer, Barry Smith pencils, Sal Buscema inks. Captured by the Beastmen, Conan is enslaved in an underground city. Sent to battle in the arena, Conan faces death and inspires the slaves to revolt.
Okay, so Conan the Barbarian, issue number 2, and this comes out...
December 1970.
December 1970, yep. Cover date, yep. And this is a...
So this book was bi-monthly.
Yes.
The first one was October.
Yes.
And this one is December.
And this one is called Lair of the Beastmen. This is really like the first proper story. And it also establishes a formula. This is a formula, by the way, that was set in the Robert E. Howard stories. Conan is recruited to do a mission. Conan goes on the mission. Conan gets captured. There's a fight. He eventually breaks free. And having gotten his money or the comely wench or whatever, he moves on. But the funny thing about it, though, is even though I recognize it as a formula and I was reading the original stories, I still enjoy it. It's like, you know, let's face it, Brad, most comics are formulaic to a certain degree.
Oh, sure. To one degree or another, there's it's particularly in this time period, because they're still, you know, in at least in the back of their head, they're still writing for a younger audience, even though they know they've got a lot of college kids. This isn't really a book that's aimed at children. Another thing that we didn't mention is that, you know, he's hacking people left and right. There's not a drop of blood to be found in either two issues.
You know, the Comics Code Authority would not allow it. And in fact, in issue 24, there's something that's interesting that the Comics Code didn't let in, but I've seen some of the original artwork. We'll get into that. But yeah, of course not. You can't. But, you know, like you said in the last episode, sometimes when you're restricted, it's better because it forces you to be more creative. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas today, I mean, I've actually seen Conan comics in the last 20 years where the blood is just dripping off the page. You know, they don't have the Comics Code to deal with.
Right.
And whereas this, it's like you have to, like, you know, he's doing it. You know, he's brutal and he will not, you know, he will not accept defeat. But yeah, he comes across these beast men. And of course, you know, the characters that inhabit, you know, the Hyborian Age, which is the age of Conan, mm-hmm. are always interesting in that they're these sort of animalistic types, but yet they can speak and, you know, be articulate.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of an interesting mix of, you know, caveman era and science fiction and almost alien, you know, you don't really explain any of it, but it's just a world of complete fantasy. I did feel like this story is a better story
than
the first issue, just as a story. But yeah, you know, as you kind of point out with the Comics Code and everything, you know, this book was a risk for Marvel because it's completely outside of Marvel continuity.
Yep.
I believe required by licensing, but the stories wouldn't call for it anyway. But, you know, you would never have, you know, the Hulk traveling back in time and meeting Conan, or
I think Conan, though, the Hulk would be the one that would probably fit the best.
Would have fit the best, but it's just, it wasn't, you know, was not going to happen. Conan lived in his own pocket universe, if you will. And you know, this, the violence isn't displayed, but it's there. And, you know, Conan, you know, there's no, with great power comes great responsibility. There's no, like, you know what I mean? There's no, like, heartwarming lessons to be
learned
in these books. Conan is, you know, a brutal, generally, you know, heartless in a lot of ways, killer. Not that he's cruel, but, you know, he's not a sweetheart.
No, and he basically has to get by using his brutality. You know, he gets recruited on these missions, and he doesn't do it for free.
Right. He's a mercenary.
Yeah, he's a mercenary. He's not doing it out of the goodness of his heart. He has to survive, and that's how you survived in those days. You know, this was obviously, you know, pre-civilization.
Yep. And you didn't really have characters like that in the Marvel Universe, probably until the Punisher, the closest, you know, kind of sort of amoral character.
Right. And Conan has no problem with that. That, as far as he's concerned, he is moral. That is his code. But he does have some exception. He doesn't, you know, Conan won't go after anybody who doesn't deserve it or.
Right. Yeah, he's not like killing kids,
No.
you
And,
know,
you know,
for the fun of it or
but he
stuff like
definitely
that.
likes, you know, he likes going on quests. He likes to drink a good flagon of ale. He likes a comely wench to bring him that flagon of ale and then, you know, accompany him back to his tent or wherever. He certainly, you know, has a lot of, let's put it this way, Conan's testosterone levels are off the charts.
Yeah, for
You
sure.
almost have to wonder how many little Conans there are spread out along the.
Oh my gosh, you know, the Hyborian Age must have been packed with little baby Conans.
Course, you know, we only see one of them, and that's in the King Conan comics, and he's apparently like an official kid. He's not, you know. But that's a long ways off. But yeah, this is definitely better. I mean, the artwork, you know, there's a subtle progression, but it's still basically not too different from,
Of a piece with the first issue,
yeah.
sure.
Which I mean, of course, it's only a couple of months later. It's a new strip. I mean, any time you have a new, especially a character like Conan who's never really been in the comics before. And by the way, Gil Kane had actually made an attempt to purchase the rights to Conan and do his own version of it, but it fell through for some reason. So, and he will come into the picture in a little bit as well.
Yeah, I believe the cover of the next issue we're going to talk about. I'm just going by my
Yeah.
eye, but it looks like Gil
It
Kane
is. It
on
is,
the
but he also will draw some issues down the line before in between Barry Windsor Smith. But yeah, this is again, this is like I said, it's of a piece, you know, it's but it's definitely a more formulated story, whereas I think the first story was really to kind of give you, okay, here's Conan, here's what he's about. The story was kind of incidental, but it's like a Marvel establishing it's movie. I'm sorry, a Marvel establishing comic where here's your character, here's what he does, here's what he's about. This one they kind of just hit the ground running. It's very similar to it's not based on a Robert E. Howard story, but it's very much in that vein. You know, like I said,
I can see
Conan
that.
gets recruited, you know, with the promise of money. He goes on a quest. They get captured. He eventually fights his way out. And then he goes on to live another day, fight another fight, you know. And I'm sure he stopped at some tavern along the way and, you know, had some ale and.
You know, one of the things I was thinking when I was reading these issues is I got a few pages into the first one and I thought, wow, man, Roy Thomas is really writing some purple prose here, as they say. And then I read just a little bit of the original Robert E. Howard books, and man, it's it's totally in that vein. I mean, Roy was just kind of aping that, but it's very like flourished language, you know, kind of over the top. But that's the way the books were written, so it's just
Yeah.
in that tradition.
The one thing I'll give Roy Thomas credit for is that he really kept it true to the Robert E. Howard character and the prose, even on his original stories, you know, whereas another writer might have been, you know, might have just tried to modernize him or just put his own little stamp on it, you know, and we know that doesn't always work out.
Yeah, I mean, you get the feeling right from the beginning that Roy has a real affinity for the character in these stories and the original work, and he's staying faithful to the tone and the feel, the flavor of the original work, which had to be borne true just by the fact that he wrote it for so damn long. You know, you don't stick with something like that if you don't if you're not just enjoying it, but really enjoying it.
Right. Before we get on to the final two issues of this Conan saga, interesting things happen along the way. Barry Windsor Smith leaves the book around issue 15. It was supposed to be his last issue. Issue 16, they reprinted The Frost Giant's Daughter from Savage Tales, which was a black and white story that they had to kind of they had to touch up a little bit to censor some parts of the female anatomy, but. So issues 17 and 18, Gil Kane comes on board as the penciler, but he only lasts two issues because Roy said, Roy wants me to draw a goddamn epic every issue. And it was, I guess there was so much involved in drawing Conan that he couldn't do other books. Like he was trying to do two books a month and he couldn't do the other book and it was depriving him of income. And it's kind of interesting, you know, the comment about Conan requiring a lot, because that's also going to factor into Barry Windsor Smith. Well, Barry Windsor Smith comes back with issue 19. Apparently, he went to do some other things and realized, hey, wait a minute, I like doing Conan. So he and, you know, Roy Thomas. Now, by this point, and this is why I wanted to wait until, why I wanted to do the first two issues of his run and the last two. By this point, Barry Windsor Smith's artwork has done a 180. His own individual style emerges, and it's very detailed, very, you know, to the point where he'll end up having to leave Conan for good because he can't do a monthly book anymore. But he comes back, and so we go to issue number 23, and Brad, why don't you tell us a little bit about Conan the Barbarian number 23?
Okay.
Conan the Barbarian number 23, The Shadow of the Vulture. From February 1973. Written by Roy Thomas, penciled by Barry Smith, with inks by Sal Buscema, Dan Adkins, and Chick Stone. An assassin named the Vulture is sent to kill Conan. Conan meets a fierce female warrior named Red Sonja, defeats the Vulture, and sends his head back in a box.
So this came out, this is February 1973, came out, of course, you know, a few months earlier. And this one is called The Shadow of the Vulture. By this point, Roy Thomas and Barry Windsor Smith have really got they're really in sync. Roy is, you know, handling the writing. I think Barry probably gets a little more involved in the plotting as well. And I believe they did it Marvel style. So, you know, by this point, Barry is just, he's probably taking liberties and probably doing whatever he wants. Well, no, I can't say whatever he wants, because by this point, Roy Thomas is now the editor-in-chief, and he's the editor of this book. So he obviously controls things. But, you know, Barry was, his style was emerging or had emerged. And this is why I wanted to jump ahead, because what a change in 24 issues, 23, 24 issues.
Yeah, you're talking essentially 2 years.
Yeah.
24 issues from issue one to this point. And I mean, just looking at them side by side, you wouldn't think it's the same artist.
You know, one thing I forgot to mention earlier, Conan at one point around issue 7 was actually canceled for like a day. Stan Lee was looking at the sales figures and didn't think it was selling a lot, or not as much as he thought. Roy Thomas convinced him, well, you know what, why don't we just give it another issue or two? And Stan's like, oh, okay, you know, that's fine, Roy. You do whatever you want. So obviously he didn't feel that strongly about it, because he was the president by this point, the publisher, or no, actually he was still the editor-in-chief. But anyway, so the sales started to pick up, and by the time, you know, this issue comes along, Conan is no longer a bi-monthly book. It's monthly.
Right.
And it's very successful. It's become one of Marvel's biggest sellers, and it's doing very well. And of course, you know, the reason for that, as we just discussed, is the progression of, you know, Barry Windsor Smith. I mean, I think Roy gets the character pretty much straight away in terms of, you know, the writing and the characteristics. And of course, his writing evolved as well. But Barry Windsor Smith, man, you talk about evolving.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, talk about the first two books, and again, I don't want to use the word generic, but it's a look that fits in with a bunch of other Marvel artists. They all, you know, it blends in. This book does not blend in with any other Marvel book.
No,
his style is very distinctive.
Yes.
You know, and it does not look like Kirby. It doesn't look like Buscema or Romita. It does not look like Neil Adams. You can see maybe some of the influences in there, but it's really become his own style that fits this kind of sword and sorcery. It's a great blend. It's like, not that it looks anything like Frazetta, but Frazetta was born to paint those kind of sword and sorcery, that kind of imagery. And Barry Windsor Smith was meant to pencil this kind of story. And it's interesting, issue 23 has three inkers, Sal Buscema, Dan Adkins, and Chick Stone. For one thing, it's interesting that it has any kind of continuity, because you know, three different inkers can really mess things up. You know, if they're inserting much of their own style at all. But you really don't get that feeling. You really feel like they're very faithful to the pencils. Cause I'm sure, people with a much better eye than I could pick it out, but I couldn't tell you which pages were inked by Buscema and which were Chick Stone and which were Dan Adkins. So, you know, they definitely, honored the original pencils, but I think that's interesting. You always wonder why something like that would happen. It must've been a time crunch.
They call it gang inking. You know, it's like they're under a time crunch. So, okay, you take the first eight pages, you take the second eight, and you take the third.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that Barry Smith was just late delivering the work.
It was getting harder for him to do the book because, as Roy Thomas put it, nobody told him to put all those lines in there, all that detail. Okay. He just had to do it. That was, you know... It's kind of the way, like when you play guitar and you write a certain way because that's the way you write. He can't not draw that way.
You know?
I'd hate to see Vince Coletta inking him.
Oh my God. It would have been a shame. He would have left out so much of that detail.
And for those of you who haven't listened to the previous episode, Vince Coletta is an infamous inker who was notorious for erasing lines and just tracing and doing very simple inking. But anyway, this also marks the first appearance of a very significant character in the Conan canon, Red Sonja. Now, the interesting thing is that this one, Sonja, spelled with a J, S-O-N-J-A. There is this Red Sonja in the Robert E. Howard stories. However, her name is spelled S-O-N-Y-A. Mm-hmm. And it's a different character. Actually, the Red Sonja in the Conan comic books is actually more of an original creation by Roy Thomas. I mean, he uses the same name, so obviously he's not getting any credit for it. But Roy Thomas has basically said it's modeled on her, but it's really more of her own. And she's as equally fierce a barbarian as Conan is. I mean, and Conan is, of course, very sexist and very, but she stands up to him. She doesn't take any shit from him.
Yeah, I mean, she eventually kind of pulls a fast one on him in the next issue. And so, you know, and I would say she's smarter than he is.
Oh yeah.
She has to be a, you know, a woman in a man's world, which that's what this is. You know, they don't really have much respect for women in the Hyborian age.
Oh.
But you know, she's not taking any crap from anyone.
No, she commands respect and she will. And I have no doubt that she could flatten Conan if she wanted to, or at least give him a run for his money. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, and of course she's beautiful. I mean, she's drawn with a sort of chainmail bikini because, of course, they wore chainmail bikinis back in the Hyborian age.
Apparently. Yeah, I would actually say, so when I was a kid, I had eventually they spun her off into her own series. And, you know, I picked up Red Sonja number one. I don't know that I probably skimmed through it, but like I said, the sword and sorcery was never my wheelhouse. So, you know, I bought it along with Omega, the Unknown number one, and Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man number one, because I thought these books, you know, new Marvel number one, I'm getting in on the ground floor. These are going to be worth a fortune. And, you know, the only one that really ever ended up being worth anything is that Peter Parker. And of course that's long gone, but anyway, I had that Red Sonja number one, and she was skimpy, wearing skimpier stuff in her own series than she was. She was, for a sword and sorcery female character, I thought in these two issues, she was fairly well dressed. You know, it's kind of a more of a, full body chainmail than like a skimpy bikini.
I just looked that up. In this issue, the Red Sonja number one, here's how they tie it into Conan. It says Fire and Fury in the Age of Conan, like in a bigger, like, yep, you know, lettering. And then it apes the issue, the cover of Conan number one, to the death, she says. And Conan says the same thing on the cover of the first. So they're obviously, this is an obvious attempt to tie this into Conan. But right, like you said, she is dressed. You know, the other thing, too, that you have to figure, by 77, the Comics Code Authority was probably a little more lenient about, you know, women in bikinis and stuff. But she makes an impression. And, of course, this is a story that will continue over into the next issue. But, yeah, this is the, you know, there's Macalette's Kingard. He's, you know, the Vulture. Of course, it's interesting that they have a character called the Vulture because, as we both know, there's a character called the Vulture in the Amazing Spider-Man.
It's a classic Spider-Man villain. Obviously, this has nothing to do with it. But, you know, as we said, Conan kind of exists in his own bubble with his, you know, no crossover into the Marvel Universe. So I guess they felt safe doing that. But, you know, going back to when we were talking about, you have to be creative when you're not allowed to show certain things.
Yep.
And this story ends with Conan cutting off the head of the Vulture and sending it back to the prince or whoever it was who hired the Vulture to kill Conan. And you don't see any of that, but you figure it out. You know, what they show is Conan, you know, fighting with the Vulture. And then they cut to a scene where this box is delivered to the king or prince or whatever. And he opens it, you know, he thinks, oh, it's some other trinket or something. And he opens it up and in shock, you know, he sees the Vulture's head in there, but they never show inside the box. They never show the head. They just show this guy looking in shock and leave it to you to figure it out. It's a very creative way to do it. And I think, you know, more effective than just showing Conan holding up a dripping head.
Right. You know? Well, obviously they were thinking outside the box.
Wah, wah.
I'm definitely going to insert a rim shot here. I'm just letting you know. I do that occasionally.
To work on that one. Did you save that one up?
Yeah. But anyway, this issue carries over to the next issue, which, before we do that, this is issue 23, by the way, is adapted from an original story by Robert E. Howard. It's an actual Conan story. So by this point, they've gotten the okay to do the stories because originally, like I told you before, they originally were not allowed to adapt, you know, Robert E. Howard's stories, but they apparently relaxed that by now. So we go to issue 24, which will be very significant. It's the last ever issue to be drawn by Barry Windsor Smith. He leaves this time. Apparently, you know, like Roy Thomas said, he was drawing so detailed that he could not, doing it monthly was just not working for him. He wasn't making enough money. And in fact, after he leaves this, he does another story for Roy Thomas in like Savage Sword or something like that, or Savage Tales. But he, for a while, he's just doing lithographs and fine art. Like he's trying to, he's obviously gotten elevated and he can do, he does come back to comics. And in fact, he did a Conan story in the 90s, but it was a crossover with a character that he had created. So Brad, why don't you tell us a little bit about Conan the Barbarian number 24?
Let's do it.
Conan the Barbarian number 24, The Song of Red Sonja, March 1973. Written by Roy Thomas, with pencils, inks, and colors by Barry Smith. Conan and Red Sonja meet in a tavern, get involved in a barroom brawl, and discover a tower and a treasure guarded by a mystical serpent.
This one, of course, is called The Song of Red Sonja. And, you know, in the very beginning, it's a, you know, talk about like, you know, she's dancing on a table and they're all going, Sonja. I think it's almost like you almost think it's like some kind of Hyborian strip club. But she's doing this for a reason. She's trying to entrance them. She's trying to, you know, but she's playing them. You know, she's playing them.
Right. Yep. It's kind of that classic thing, you know, meet in a tavern, they have a brawl, they go on an adventure.
Yep.
And spoiler alert, she pulls a fast one on Conan, but he can't help but be impressed.
Oh yeah. He respects her. And in fact, there's a scene where they're alone together in like a lake or something, or a pond.
Hot tub.
A hot tub, yeah. And Conan puts his arms around her, and you can see his arms like on her lower back. And she's like, "Ah, oh, what are you doing?" He pulls back partly because he respects her, and partly because he knows that if he tries to do anything, she'd kill him, or she'd at least maim him. But there's an interesting thing about that. In the omnibus, they actually showed the original artwork. Let's just say that Conan's hands were a little lower. There is no way that they were going to allow Conan the Barbarian to grab her ass in a, you know, Comics Code Authority approved comic. But I did see the original artwork, and it was kind of like funny to look at. And there's also something very interesting that Barry Windsor Smith did. Barry Windsor Smith suggested, like, instead of referring to someone as a jerk, why don't you call him a wank? Roy Thomas did not. You and I obviously know what wanking is an English euphemism for. And if we're not going to tell you, folks, because if you don't know, whatever. Anyway, but he assured Roy Thomas that it was a harmless word. It was just like, you know, means jerk or, you know, goofball or whatever. Well, so they published it, and it got published. And, you know, because it's a British, you know, slang term, the Comics Code Authority did not pick up on it. So it got published with a British, you know, curse word or whatever. Well, Roy Thomas eventually found out about it, and apparently he carried a grudge. He says, "I don't like it when people lie to me." And Roy Thomas, as you know, you've read enough probably about Roy Thomas. He's a very principled person, and he's not someone to give in. You know, he said that he was very mad, and he never really forgave Barry Windsor Smith for it. But it's kind of interesting. So, you know, how many, you know, American kids reading that comic, you know, didn't realize they were reading a British curse word? And then, of course, I'm sure when the book came out in Britain, they probably was like, "Ah, good on you, mate. You know, good on you."
That's funny.
But this is, you know, again, this is his last issue. And Barry Windsor Smith not only drew this, but he inked it and he colored it. I mean, he went out guns blazing. And this is really, I mean, Red Nails Aside, which was the black and white story I believe he did after this, this is really Barry Windsor Smith at his peak as far as Conan goes.
Well, it's certainly the most pure, unadulterated Barry Smith you're going to get from this period, because, like you said, he penciled it, he inked it, he even colored it. You know, he did everything except manufacture the paper pretty much on this. You know, that's obscure as you get. You know, and he would later go on to do some covers and a few miniseries and things like that. But, you know, this is really where he made his name, you know, on this series. He'll always be identified with Conan.
Well, you know, you think about it. If they had had the money, John Buscema would have drawn this from day one. And, you know, I love John Buscema's Conan, but you don't really see a big progression in his Conan versus Barry Windsor Smith's Conan.
Well, yeah, by then Buscema's art was, you know, he'd nailed down his
Oh, yeah. And, you know, and granted, I do agree that he probably draws Conan more the way he should be, bigger, stockier. You know, he, like, the next issue will be the debut of John Buscema. And, of course, what's interesting is that this is not the end of the storyline. This actually carries over into the next issue, and I think, the next issue. So, but I wanted this to be a cutoff point because, like I said, I wanted to show the progression in basically 2 years worth of comics. I mean, I know it's spread out over 2 years, but 24 issues is essentially 24 is two years of a monthly comic. His style progressed. I mean, granted, he didn't draw every issue, but he drew most of them. I think he drew like 20 out of the 24. And that's in, you know, if you want to include the reprint issue. Interestingly enough, like 22, there was a snafu with the artwork not getting there on time. So 22 is actually a reprint of the first issue. I mean, that's pretty, you know, they didn't have a vast repertoire of Conan comics to reprint. So they had to just, you know, and back then you didn't want to miss. I think there are penalties if they missed an issue with the printers, like, because the printers already had everything set up. But I really feel like, you know, he ended it on a high note. And if you can still, I would recommend getting the Conan Omnibus or the two Epic collections that collect this run, because, you know, I don't know if these books are going to get, they were reprinted by Dark Horse in the early 2000s. But here's an interesting thing. Those were scanned from, I guess, Spanish reprints. So they had to redo the lettering, and you can tell it's redone. And it was also that age when they were remastering the color, and it was just too dark, and it obscured a lot of the line work. I didn't notice it at first. Then I read something online that showed the original artwork with coloring. The omnibus that Marvel put out a few years ago does restore the original coloring. And they actually they published the first issue as one of those facsimile editions a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years ago, actually. So, but this is, you know, he's ending on a high note. Like I said, you know, the Conan formula is basically, you know, they get Conan gets recruited. In this case, he's with Red Sonja. You know, they defeat their enemy. And then in this case, of course, Sonja pulls. And we'll see Red Sonja quite a bit down the line. I mean, she'll come back every so often to Conan, like usually maybe once or twice a year. And she factors heavily into the overall saga. But this is definitely the end of an era. It's my favorite era of Conan, although, like I said, I love the John Buscema stuff, but there's just something about this that's just really special.
Yeah, like I said, it's not really in my wheelhouse, but in particularly these two issues, just, you know, the artwork is beautiful, and just looking at his work, you know, you can't help but be impressed. Just great talent.
I've often wondered why, like, you know, because Roy Thomas, even though he stopped writing Conan a long time ago, he has come back occasionally and done some miniseries and for, like, Dark Horse. I've always wondered, like, it's getting to the point where they're getting old. I mean, Roy Thomas is like, 83 or 82 years old. Mm-hmm. I've often wondered why it would be great if those two could get back together and do, like, another Conan comic, maybe, like, a miniseries or something. I mean, obviously, at this point, we don't expect them to do our monthly series, but maybe do, like, a four-issue miniseries. Of course, Barry Windsor-Smith's style has even changed since then, you know, but it's equally as interesting. And, you know, as all artists do, they evolve and change as they grow older. I mean, even Kirby, you know, when he did like this stuff at DC, was kind of at a different level.
Yeah. Yeah. In some cases, kind of refining your style down to the basic elements that make as you see it, as the artist, that make up your personal style. Sometimes it's a complete transition. Like in this case, where, again, you would think the artist from issues 1 and 2 is a completely different guy than drew 24, because it changed so much. So, you know, I mean, and sometimes artists just very early on find their style and they don't really deviate much from it. But it, you know, it's all valid, it's all art, and ultimately it's in the eye of the beholder as to whether you like it or it works for you or not. But I don't see how anyone could look at these books, particularly these latter two, and just, really be impressed by his style, his eye, his design.
Barry Windsor-Smith may not draw Conan as brawny as John Buscema does, but let's face it, that's John Buscema. He draws all his, you know, his heroes brawny and muscular, and, you know, but again, you know, by this point, he's probably 19 or 20 years old at this point. Because, like I said, they age him 1 year, for every year of the comic, he ages a year. It's real time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and like I said, King Conan, you know, comes further on down the line. But obviously, he made it a big impression. And, you know, it's you almost wonder what would have happened if he'd stayed on the book a little while longer. But, you know, things happened for a reason, and he was destined to go on to do other things. I mean, he, you know, did a Wolverine series called Weapon X at one point. But, I don't have much else to say about it, Brad. I don't know about you.
No, I think we've said our piece. So, yeah, just thank everyone once again for listening. And we'll be back again soon with another handful of classic books to banter about.
Well, that's why we call it Back Issue Banter, Brad, you know.
That is true.
So anyway, thanks for, like Brad said, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Take care, everyone.
Mr. K Super Show.
If you love the music of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, join me every month when I and a guest co-host discuss music and music-related pop culture. No stone goes unturned, no bit of trivia is too trivial as we discuss the great music of Generation X, hosted by Chris Carra. Mr. K's Super Show can be found on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are hosted. Check it out. You may not regret it.
Hey, this is Brad Page from the I'm in Love with That Song podcast, inviting you to join me as we explore a different song each episode, discovering what makes these songs great. The performances, arrangements, and the production tricks and techniques are all part of creating those magic moments that turn a good song into a great one. On this podcast, we take a deep dive into each song, listening to all those nuances that came together to make it a great song. Our journey takes us across the musical map, from the Beatles and the Stones to Aretha Franklin and Tom Petty, from Aerosmith to the Zombies. We listen to it all on the I'm in Love with That Song podcast.
Thank you for listening to Back Issue Banter. If you like what you heard, please post a review on Apple Podcasts and please share on social media. On behalf of Brad Page and myself, Chris Karam, thanks once again for listening to Back Issue Banter.